talk about this, but it is important to me. I view this book in some ways as a tribute to public defenders. I view this book as giving the voice of public defenders and our care for our clients and our love for the work, elevating that. I try to express that on the pages because I do believe that if we're going to have any meaningful transformation of our criminal legal system, that public defenders are going to have to be a core, central part of that conversation. I mean, we are the people who are tasked with telling our clients stories and giving our clients humanity before the court. We're the people, and in our office, we prided ourselves. Our mentality was, yes, you've always gotten the worst. You've gotten the worst schools. You've gotten the worst housing. Nobody in the social service bureaucracy has cared enough for you. And right at this moment, when you're most vulnerable, when society is really turning its back on you, we are going to give you the best. We are going to fight day and night from sunup till sundown and on weekends to represent you. And that kind of spirit, I'm not saying it's everywhere, and I understand that public defenders, you know, I work a lot with people who are incarcerated, and I know that they have a negative view because in many cases they didn't get that from their public defender. But I think that's possible. It's possible to provide that level of representation more broadly and more systematically. And that if we did that, many of the things that we're seeing now, many of the injustices would be minimized.
James Forman Jr., author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, and Libby Rainey, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Godarz, and Karl Marxer. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host the class Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th and 4 p.m. at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally and nationally, KBOO hip hop programming, how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, rhyme, writing, and production, and how liberation struggles have contributed to hip-hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future at Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw on Saturday, July 7th at 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It's 8:02 and you're listening to KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550. And now it's time for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you.
was born inside a hospital with a 9-digit number code. I pledged allegiance to the flag when I was only 4 years old. The first thing that I learned in school is we are a country free. One bad forces attack our land, I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I joined the Scouts when I was 12 and put on a uniform. I learned there how to fold the flag and how the look of a proud man was worn. We camped in the mountains, deserts and plains. We hiked through the giant trees. And I saw God in the beauty there. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. In a cluttered mind, the young man walks all alone. 6,000 miles away he finds, for the first time that he feels at home. And he laughs to himself as he faces his fear in the land of the mighty grizzly. It once was like this everywhere. I'll fight for my country. It once was like this everywhere. I'll fight for my country. Now I love this river, love this land, and I love my green mountain home. And when they come to cut the forest here, they won't be fighting me alone. 'Cause the wildlands are the places we go to remember what it means to be free. When bad forces attack our land, I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country. I'll fight for my country.
Good morning. This is Paul Rowan. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I guess when you do a talk show on July 4th, you feel somewhat obligated to make it relevant. I always try to make my show relevant in one way or another. I hope I do. Anyway, 503-231-8187. I'm here by myself. Love to talk to you. That was Dana Lyons. That was from his epic Cows with Guns CD, if you remember that. Going back to, 1996, I think. Yeah, well, that's about as good a patriot prayer as I can think of. Now, I can't imagine convincing or converting the Joey Gibsons of the world to that point of view, but gosh, it's so much more compelling than the way they look at things. So retrograde. I wasn't out there the other day in Portland. Maybe some of you were. Might want to share your perspective on these ongoing running battles between the fascistoids and the anti-fascists. Patriot Prayer. Yeah, well, that song came out kind of at the, not really the tail end, sort of the middle of the Forest Wars. I guess almost the tail end at that point, but it really resonated with me at the time, someone who came out west, didn't know nothing about these mighty forests that we have out here, the ancient forests, the original ecosystems, which exist so rarely on our poor, beleaguered, battered planet at this point, where you could go and actually feel like, yeah, remember what it is to be free. I think there's something to that. I mean, maybe there's, or certainly there is, some privilege that goes along with it. White skin privilege, class privilege, to be able to enjoy those things. I don't deny that. But the reality is there. The reality that long predates our European arrival and most of the other arrivals, except for the indigenous. Actually, it predates the indigenous, if one believes the hypothesis that indigenous people arrived here some... they're pushing it further and further back. 15 to 25,000 years ago. Well, that's a subject we don't need to get into. Patriot prayer. What does it mean to be a patriot? Well, it's a very patriarchal term to begin with. So what I want to talk about, and I'm sure you have things that you want to talk about. I'm open. But it is July 4th. It is a time of reflection. We heard from James Forman Jr. talking about some deep stuff, the ongoing legacy of slavery, the lies that people and an entire culture, entire society has to tell itself to justify the existence of slavery and the abuse of enslaved people and the continued abuse of the descendants of those people. That's one pillar of the bad faith of American culture. You know what the term bad faith means? I think Jean-Paul Sartre made that a more widespread concept. Basically, that you're doing something that is really against your own principles, ethics, and so you basically have to kind of split yourself off and tell yourself lies or stories to make it acceptable, to deal with the cognitive dissonance. Anyway, so slavery, but the other pillar, of course, is the theft, expropriation, also enslavement. People may not be that familiar with the widespread practice of the slavery of the indigenous peoples as well, and there a lot of them were captured and sent off to the Caribbean, work in the plantations there. There was a fairly widespread slavery in the southeastern United States of the indigenous peoples. Anyway, so we're talking about history. We're talking about the flawed, false foundations that this country was based upon that we've never dealt with, never gotten over. The past isn't just the past, as those Patriot Prayer people like to say, as I tried to engage them in conversation, several of those events that they had down the waterfront. I think they're fundamentally deluded. I think they're continuing to live the lie and not learning, willing to face the facts and learn the lesson and become real adults in this complex world that we live in. So I came across an article. I went to see RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Tremendous movie, by the way. I was blown away at how impressive that woman, what a single-handed impact, influence she had on the on women's rights, on the whole wide areas of women's rights, even, you know, well before she got on the Supreme Court. There's my ignorance again. But one thing I did remember as well is that she made a ruling in the City of Sherrill versus Oneida Indian Nation that she cited the doctrine of discovery uncritically. The doctrine of discovery, of course, being this idea that the first Christian nation to supposedly discover another land outside what was known as the known Christian world at the time, they had the right to that the land. Well, they, you know, it's sort of unclear. Do they have the no strings attached right? Did they have to form treaties? They eventually, you know, because the competition between different nations made treaties with the indigenous peoples as a sort of pro forma thing to basically justify their claim as opposed to other claims. And so really the process for making treaties, important as it was and remains as a foundation for the remaining rights, but there was a lot of flaws in the treaty making process, and there's a lack of adequate interpretation. There's various manipulations of the process, introduction of alcohol, getting people drunk, cherry picking, choosing their own leader that may not have been the principal recognized leader, or there may have been a completely different leadership system, and the English may and other colonizing powers may have imposed their own ideas, structures of leadership in order to basically curry favor with one person or one group in a tribe and win them over to where the English and other wanted to go. So, but the treaties, they did make treaties, and these treaties are the basis of the remaining land base and whatever remains of indigenous autonomy, independence. So yeah, one of the reasons they mentioned this on OPB this morning, they read the Declaration, I guess I was at National Public Radio, read the entire Declaration of Independence, I was listening to that, and mentioned that one of the reasons for the Revolutionary War was actually that there was talk of ending the slave trade in England at the time, and there was powerful forces in the United States, in what became the United States, what were the colonies, that absolutely did not want that. Another reason that a lot of people don't recognize was the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which basically prohibited, or made an attempt to prohibit, the settlement on the other side of the what was the dividing line, which is along a certain ridge line along the Appalachians. Not sure if it was the Blue Ridge. Anyway, and there was, because, you know, one of the major reasons for colonists coming over here was the possibility for, quote, free land because of the, well, the feudal system was bad enough, but with the rise of industrial capitalism, there was the enclosures, the British enclosures was enclosing common land and privatizing land, privatizing work in ways that were unprecedented and uprooting massive numbers of people. So there's this surge of people coming from England, Scotland, Ireland, from Germany, from a few other places at the time, and they wanted free land. They wanted, you know, to be their own. That was, I don't think people really understand how powerful a force was the desire for land, because they didn't have autonomy in Europe, and they were seeking to form their own autonomy. Unfortunately, the autonomy that then they created was on the backs of the enslavement of African people and the suppression of the autonomy and independence and the taking away of it by taking away their land of the indigenous peoples. So those are the foundations of this country, and it's basically still here. And especially as Euro-Americans, which I am, my mother's people actually on her German side, her dad's side, go back actually to before the revolution. Fought in the French and Indian Wars, as they are called, in this part of the Virginia Militia, the origins of the militias, which we talk about, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz talks about in her latest book about history of the Second Amendment. The idea of militias, some people talk about militias, I know I'm kind of going all over the place, but, you know, it's all germane, that this idea that people criticize, you know, in terms of the Second Amendment, that, you know, people aren't really members of the militia. No, actually, the idea of the militias is every person, every, you know, free citizen, which, of course, didn't include women, didn't include blacks, didn't include Native Americans at the time, but, and that's the whole entire point. They were members of the militia, and the militias, like the Virginia militia, were either organized, more or less organized by state forces, colonial forces, or they were self-organized, as in California, when they viciously hunted down the indigenous people as part of their lust for wealth and their desire for their own independence upon the backs of others. So the militias, the need to arm themselves was a function of their need to protect themselves from the people that they were displacing and enslaving. And that still remains largely true. In fact, the whole rise of the modern NRA really came in the 1960s as a function of the challenge from some of these suppressed, oppressed groups, that some of whom wanted to openly display their arms, like the Black Panthers, and it freaked out the white people, who I call Americaners, as a kind of parallel to the Afrikaners. Well, so I've introduced a subject. Oh, I wanted to read, since they kind of glossed over it in the reading of the Declaration of Independence. You know, there's some highfalutin language. You know, Jefferson knew how to write. He has abdicated government here, they're talking about, I guess, King George, by declaring us out of his protection and waging war against us. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages and totally unworthy of the head of a civilized nation. He has constrained our fellow citizens taken captive on the high seas to bear arms against their country, to become the executioners of their friends and brethren, or to fall themselves by their hands. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us. That's interesting. More to say about that, perhaps, and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. They said that. I was wondering what they were going to do with it. I knew that was coming as I was listening to it on National Public Radio this morning. I was wondering what they were going to do with that, you know, change their tone of voice, put a little parenthesis, say something afterwards. Seemed somewhat obligatory, but no, they didn't. You know, I guess they just wanted to read the Declaration of Independence. Anyway, that's the last thing they say. That's the last, like, they list all these injustices and reasons for basically waging a war, a revolutionary war of independence against the crown. That was the last one listed. And then it says, in every age of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress. In the most humble terms, our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. And of course, what Jefferson doesn't say, and what they didn't clarify on NPR, was that, I mean, who started the gosh darn wars? I mean, come on, a little bit of reality here. And again, it disguises, you know, this idea, the lies that we have to tell ourselves to justify, in this case, when James Forman said the existence of slavery, in this case, the very colonization and continued expropriation of the lands of and the war against the indigenous peoples, what excited the these people's passions most was the fact that they couldn't conquer, couldn't colonize more land, which would basically lead to more warfare, into the kind of reaction from the indigenous peoples, which, you know, frankly, you got to admit is really understandable. If someone's coming and taking your land, what are you going to do? If, you know, it's like every area was occupied. It wasn't just vacant land. Everybody had hunting territories, gathering territories. There's some degree of, you know, competition. There's also a lot of sharing, a lot of, you know, intermarriage. There's very complex social relationships, which Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz outlines in her Indigenous People's History of the United States very admirably, which we all would do well if we haven't yet read. Well, anyway, again, that's I'm continuing my long introduction. If you want to continue to listen to me, I'll be glad to keep going. But if you'd like to engage in whatever way, 503-231-8187. That's the number. Kind of, there's various questions I wanted to put out. Of course, there's lots of other things I want to talk about, but, you know, is the United States really worth saving? I don't know. I mean, we're at such a sorry pass. You know, the United States, the hyper industrialization that the United States was enabled to buy its vast territory, which it illegitimately gained, and the vast amounts of resources that miraculously were here, that because of the Industrial Revolution we both, quote, needed and were able to make use of, and our vast expansion globally allowed this tremendous amount of power and led to, as I said, a hyper-industrialization and a spread of the American way of life, which is basically just a kind of a mutation of the English way of life, the European way of life, which was already problematic for the world's peoples, given the colonization and the horrors that it wrought around the world. Added to those human social horrors, there is now the horror of annihilation from ecological meltdown and climate change. So anyway, when that Dana Lyons song, which we started out with, My Country, came along, I was very young and hopeful, and it was a kind of an anthem for a different way of looking at, you know, kind of self-defense or fighting for what's right, and or a different take on, you know, what is our country. And of course I joined forces with the Native Americans, struggling along with them for their own rights and gaining an understanding of the indigenous history in this part of the world, and the treaties and the treaty rights. And so my sense of what's my country basically was really, I'm here thanks to them, and I'll fight for some, really, their country. And to the extent that we're able to make alliances, great. And I was very hopeful that we would move forward, you know, through this kind of anti-globalization movement, and which led to the famous Battle of Seattle, just 3 years after this CD came out, Cows with Guns, Dandelions. And yeah, so there was very hopefulness for me in that time, despite the continuing sort of inexorable grinding of the neoliberal model, capitalist model. But there really was a challenge. Of course, 9/11 had a pretty significant impact on that. And I, for some strange reason, moved away to Italy, kind of lost contact. But here we all are, and now we've got Donald Trump, and we've got this renewed, what used to be called nativism, which is a somewhat problematic term, I guess, if you contrast it with indigenism, you can see. But nativism was, you know, back in the aughts, teens, 20s, was this anti-immigrant backlash as a time of massive immigration from especially Italy, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe. And now we're in this renewed kind of end of days seeming anti-immigration backlash, with this idea of that these Mexican people who, you know, we of course stole a good chunk of their country in the War of Mexico in 1846 to 1848. But I'm sure you already know all this stuff. This is nothing new. Did anybody listen to Howard Zinn, the wonderful, wonderful Howard Zinn on, what's it called, Alternative Radio, I think? David Barsamian's program that airs every Tuesday morning here on KABU Community Radio at 9 a.m. If you're not a regular listener, check it out. He always has some great talks on there. Howard Zinn from, God, was that 95, 96? What a wonderful human being. We really need more Howard Zinns at this particular juncture, and some form of miracle. Well, let's see. I've said a lot of the things I want to talk about. Speaking of the idea of aliens, I've always thought there's some strange sort of sublimation or some sort of strange psychological projection process. You know, we use the term alien for extraterrestrial aliens, and for people who are supposedly illegal immigrants here to our to North America. And I think of the film Independence Day, came out July 3rd, also I think 1996. So something about that year. That was kind of the year that I left for Italy, 1996. Anyway. So let me just refer, before we go to Karen, who's waiting on the line, this article just came out on Counterpunch, Three Climatic Monsters with Asteroid Impact. You know, we've got these disaster flicks, you know, an asteroid is going to hit the Earth. Aliens are invading Earth. Got to mobilize, you know, face this threat. And we have aliens on the Mexican border, horrors, when, you know, the real threat is the fact that we're fraying this precious, delicate delicate but extremely resilient over millions of years, but we've succeeded in completely altering the chemistry of our atmosphere such that we're running the risk of actually basically destroying the foundations for our own life on the planet. And here we're distracted by these things. Anyway, I could go on and on. Let's hear what Karen has to say. Go on, you're on the air.
Oh, you've been wonderful, as usual, Paul. Really laid out a lot of wonderful ideas and tragic also commentary on history. I just wanted to raise the question of freedom from violence. You and I talked on a little bit after your show one day when you were just personing the phones, and I wanted to say a few things about violence and get your opinion. It seems to me that if we don't have democratic approaches to trying to get a socialism implemented, that we are more likely to get sociopathic personalities heading a state. It just historically looks that way, with Stalin heading the state in the Soviet Union and eventually Mao heading the state in China. And what that looks like when you get 10 to 30 million people dying in China, and when you in the Cultural Revolution, and when you get 20 million peasants being executed in the Soviet Union, and all the political oppression and so forth. And I've been puzzling over this question my whole political life, my whole adult life, really, and wondering why it is that we get plunged into these horrible wars, and why we can't figure out other ways of handling our differences and of sharing rather than having to dominate. And I love your focus on Native American beliefs and practices and social structures, because they seem to do, at least now, they seem to have so much to offer to us. And I am not saying that I have any right to tell oppressed people how to do their struggle. I don't feel that at all. And many, many years ago, I was on a legal defense committee for the Black Liberation Army. There were three brothers who were captured in New Haven after they had robbed a bank. And they had shot a guard, but he wasn't, thank God, killed. And the people who had picked up arms, and in many ways justifiable grievances, they saw the violence that was being done against them as members of the Black community, and they saw no way out except through struggle, because they couldn't get employed, and anyways, all the complexities of that social and economic and political system.
Structural and violence,
so they got captured, and some of their support teams that were also part of the BLA eventually were killed in shootouts and so on. So I witnessed all this, and I was horrified by what we saw on the international stage with violence. And I just wondered what your take is on how we build communities and community structures and ways of behaving and ways of approaching one another that are nonviolent.
I'm sorry, I laughed. It's just such a big question. You're putting me in the position of pronouncing on things that are. But no, what you're saying is bringing up so many. Let me just hold you off right there. So did you have discussions on violence and nonviolence at the time with those people?
I did not. Okay. No, we were this little group that was trying to be support system for their families and children and such, and we would write to them, to the brothers who were incarcerated, and we would try to prevent egregious attacks on them in court. I stood up with my fist in the air at one point when one of them was being roughed up by a guard, and of course all the guns were trained on me, and I got kicked out of court and so forth. But that time, I didn't even really pose these questions, except that it was to me it was a tactical a tragic tactical mistake to try to do struggle this way.
Right. Well, that's, you see,
that was just where I was at.
Right.
I couldn't even imagine a larger way of framing it, except being defeated by the violence. That was just about. I was young, you know. It's just where I was. So I never got to talk to them, except, you know, we would talk a little bit about tactics. But they were in such a tragic situation. They faced 25 years in prison, and that's what they got.
Well, let me just. I think you're bringing up. Okay, to me, you're bringing up two things that are resonating with me. One is this huge question of, you said socialism. I would posit it somewhat differently. I mean, I think it goes back further. It goes back to the origins of the kind of, you know, the kind of mass hierarchical society that's different from, you know, really smaller face-to-face, kinship-based communities. And that transition is, you know, that boat left the dock a long time ago. And or that genie left the bottle, or however you want to put it, that's a huge question. I think we do need to have. The other question is, you know, in our current situation, you know, whatever situation we found ourselves in, whether when you were a lot younger with the Black Liberation Army, which, you know, basically came out of the, you know, the Black Panthers and came out of that whole milieu of the 1960s. So, you know, that's the context. You know, my context, a similar context for me might be, say, how the Earth Liberation Front emerged out of Earth First, for example. There's a parallel thing, you know, that, or you could say how the Weather Underground emerged out of, you know, the Students for a Democratic Society. I think there's parallels to all these things. You know, one could say, well, it just wasn't, you know, that was just adventurism. That's kind of a classic analysis, that the time really wasn't right for revolution, and their idea that they could lead by example and, you know, everybody would follow was, you know, in retrospect shown to be clearly false, because it didn't happen that way. And so one could say, well, the conditions just weren't right. You know, that's, I guess, I kind of think that way. So yeah, I mean, but it, can you in the heat of the moment, can you really predict? You know, you can't think in retrospect in the heat of the moment. So these are really hard questions to address. I mean, the question, is violence always wrong? I don't think so. So that's, you know, that's my short answer. If you're asking me that, no, I think that, you know, I think that is violence justified? I don't know. I guess it can be justified in retrospect if you win your war of independence, or you defeat the invading group, whatever. Yeah, I mean, does violence always corrupt? No, I think you can recover. I think there, you know, what we've lost are the kind of mechanisms, cultural and social mechanisms, like, you know, when indigenous groups, I don't know how universal it was, I've heard of cases where they went to war, when they came back, they had to do ceremony to basically, you know, heal, because it's a sort of a bloodlust. If you read accounts of the early colonial wars, the Pequod War, the native groups, I've said this on the show before, that were fighting because they were fighting against their traditional enemies alongside the British, but they got so disgusted they left the field, because they'd never seen warfare like that. Because once you unleash that kind of bloodlust, it's like slavery. Once it sets in motion and it becomes institutionalized, the whole culture becomes dehumanized and it becomes acceptable. And that's why people are so afraid of the moment we're in with Trump. It's like people make these comparisons to, you know, fascism and Nazism, because once it gets established, the train leaves the station and there's no stopping it. I don't know. I'm going.
I hear you on that one.
Yeah.
I have a whole lot of sentiment about around World War II, and personally, I think I would have been rolling bandages, but at least at this stage of life, when I was younger, I think I would have been more active in an underground or something. but I have no opposition to the fact that people took up arms to get rid of the Nazis and the Axis power domination. It was beyond belief.
Unfortunately, the powers of the world let it go so far that massive warfare became inevitable. There are so many places where it could have been nipped in the bud if people hadn't seen Hitler as a convenient force against the Soviet Union or, you know, whatever. It's just the lies again that we tell ourselves are endless.
Yeah. And as you say, I am one of those people who is very afraid of what's emerging in this country and globally, seeing all the fascist, Nazi-esque characteristics of cultures and societies that are coming forth. It's very, very frightening. And so, as part of the resistance movement, because the question it never really gets answered. For young people now, you see young people resorting to tactics that are, from my point of view, unwise. I can't put an old head on young shoulders, right? As my grandmother used to say, but it's unwise to do what they're doing, it seems to me.
Well, let's stop there. Let's stop there because you know, we can get into that, but you know, we're going to have to go to another caller in a second here. But the whole generational separation. I mean, I feel like I personally, in some sense, abdicated because I basically left the country for 14 years. I feel like I could have had a role, say, in. I think the Earth Liberation Front was a mistaken way to go at the time, but I left the field, and I think a lot of, you know, older activists have either, you know, died or burnt out or moved on, or, you know, are just not in touch with the young people. There's this, not only, you know, cultural and institutional like amnesia, there's just this generational like lack of continuity, which is endemic. And the older people don't have a role because either we've abdicated that role or just the cultural forces are such that, you know, I think that's the problem there. You know, whether people are doing the right thing, if you're talking about Antifa or whatever, you know, those are issues that need to be hashed out in public forums and discussions or in movement building, but hopefully that's happening.
And one-on-one, some Quakers are going to go down to the occupation on Friday and try to sit down and talk to people and get their opinions and offer perspectives and such, and most of us will be older. And for whatever good that can do, I agree, we have to engage in dialogue, but you should take your other caller. I always appreciate your show. Thank you so much, Paul.
Okay. Well, thanks for an extended conversation this morning. Let's see who our next... who's our next caller, Liam?
Hello, Paul.
Oh, there we go. Who are you?
Yeah, this is BT.
Right on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, listen, I'm not going to see the RGB film, or is it RBG? I'm not much of a fan of hers, but the way I look at Supreme Court justices is that there are times when I like all of them, depending on the case. I don't like to really demonize or completely trash any of them, and even the ones I would like more often, or sometimes I really wish they weren't there for certain cases. Now, I just ask you about the film. Did they kind of gloss over the Kelo versus New London decision?
Which one?
That was probably her low point.
Which one is that?
No, that was the one, the final nail in the coffin on the property rights with the eminent domain, where the five justices on the Supreme Court, which... said that government could decide what public use is, and that means that anything is a public use, so that there's no limitation on the reason for taking someone's property, because the Constitution does say it lay out things. You know, it has to be just compensation. It says public use, and that means that the feds do have oversight over it. It's not something that's just left to the states to define. And but what they did was they defined that. So, you know, government can, local, in this case, the Connecticut government wanted to show the people that they were governing and they were going to bring more money into the city. So they let Pfizer, so they gave, took land away from people, homes, and gave it to Pfizer, the big pharmaceutical outfit or some kind of a big development that would include Pfizer and stores and all this other stuff they want. And that was wrong. And,
so you think that, and you think that might have had an impact on, say, some of these pipeline cases?
No, because those cases were actually dealt with earlier, where you're talking about a right-of-way, and they had to be argued for. That came about from the early 1800s. There used to be the Mill Acts, when there were a lot of people who had mills along the rivers, and they would have, you know, grind grain for everybody, and then they were allowed to build a mill and a dam, and therefore, you know, some people's land would be flooded, but provided everybody got to use that mill. But even that had to be argued, and it wasn't clear in the Constitution as written. But still, but this was anything goes. This decision meant anything goes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting, because that.
But anyway, the thing is that the justices that a lot of people on this station really hate, you know, Thomas, Scalia, Rehnquist, they were all on the side of the right side, the little guy, and they were joined with the ACLU and the NAACP, who hated to see poor people have their land taken away by some local government that was bragging about how they were governing. That's another story. I guess they probably glossed over that in the documentary. It was probably an embarrassing thing. But I just want to.
Well, let me.
Oh, go ahead.
They didn't talk about that case. I introduced this and didn't really go into it. The city of Sherrill versus Oneida Indian Nation, which is basically where the city of Sherrill was like leasing the city from the Oneidas for like a ridiculous rate for I don't know how long, and I guess it was coming up for revisiting. And again, I should be able to tell you the ins and outs of the case, but the main point of this article by Stephen Newcomb on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's book My Own Words, where she again cited this doctrine of discovery, which was basically written into the,
I heard you talking about it earlier,
federal legal system through the early Johnson, the Supreme Court head of Supreme Court Johnson, his early decisions, which basically declared the indigenous nations to be domestic dependent nations. They did this really distorted legal logic in order to basically accommodate a measure of sort of cultural autonomy and sort of limited ratification of the drastically reduced land bases that they had, but also sort of put them under the thumb of the Congress, the plenary power of Congress, by saying they're domestic dependent, which is a very strange legal concept. Anyway, she ratified that concept as recently, and when that decision was, I think, 2005. And so, yeah, those are two major, major decisions where she basically kind of followed a less than enlightened legal philosophy. But again, to her credit, she did do amazing things for women's rights in her legal career.
Like I said, they all do some good things, even some justices that you probably despise. If you look at some of their decisions, you're probably glad they were there for those cases. But to move on to the slavery thing, I've always thought, this stuff we hear from the Zins and everything, you know, the Europeans and the Americans, created slavery or pretty close to it, or the major forces.
No, I don't think they ever said that.
Slavery, yeah, that's what, this is the kind of thing that comes across as if everybody else is innocent now.
No, I don't think
to
so.
Me,
slavery, I don't think so. I don't think
slavery
so.
Slavery is a
you
blot
could, you
on
could, you should
the
cite,
world.
What, where do they ever say that?
Okay, when does the civilizations in Africa that did exist for many, many centuries, because a lot of the European influence was just on the coast. They knew nothing about the interior. How often do you read in America that their role in it, major role in the slave trade, or even Arabs or in the Indians in India? For many, many centuries, the slave trade was going on for many, many centuries, and the Europeans just simply tapped into it and became a market.
Well, just simply is kind of minimizes the role. I mean, that does, you know, there's a
minimizes old, what role?
Well, it minimizes the fact that it was an abhorrent system of
basically it's a blot on humankind.
Well, yeah, but I mean, so where did slave? You know, if you want to really universalize the discourse, you know, yeah, you can. Where did slavery originate? Was slavery always existing? Well, probably not. These are deep, deep, large questions. But when you have to, so you have to limit your discourse to a certain framework. So if we're limiting our discussion to the United States and its origins, you know, you can't necessarily bring in everything. And I don't think Howard Zinn.
Oh, I don't mind that at all. I don't mind when you're talking about that, because like I said, it existed.
Right. But does that justify? But that doesn't justify slavery in the United States, does it?
No. I never said that. What I don't like is, and I'm not going to name names. I might say one. You know, someone like Joe Yoris will say we created slavery, or this country was founded. They made sure that slavery was a big part of it, as if, you know, they just paint this picture of European ships showing up in Africa and then kidnapping a bunch of people and bringing them over here, when they're actually buying them from Africans who were doing the kidnapping and then selling them.
Right. Okay. Okay.
And
let's
just think that's part of a bigger picture.
No, I agree. I agree. Okay, but listen, let me just say this though, because are you still there?
Well, yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. So, but even within the context, because no, I think that's an important thing that you're bringing up. The thing is, though, I think that with the development of capitalism and investments, banking investments, you know, like the Bank of England was virtually created on the backs of the international slave trade, with those mechanisms, they exacerbated. Because so I'm not justifying the slavery that did exist, but I would almost guarantee that it was a much more culturally limited phenomenon until you had the phenomenon of the international transatlantic slave trade. That opened up and made it much bigger.
I don't really know about that, because there was a lot of cross, you know, you're going across the Indian Ocean. I mean, that's the Atlantic was just one side, but, you know, there's a lot of water between Africa and India, and in some ways the Mideast, your ship travel. So that was a big trade that was going on, and they were actually worse than they used to castrate a lot of them. Figures I've read that were coming up from historians was that of all the slaves that were sent across the Atlantic, this is just the Atlantic, only about 5% came to what became the United States. So those other 95% were going to South America and the Caribbean. So even the French Revolution, which a lot of people, you know, think was better than the American Revolution, they did nothing about slavery because it was ongoing and it kept it going. And they had loads of slaves. You ought to read about Haiti. They had many, many slaves there, and they were really brutal with them, and they kept bringing in new ones just because they were dying. But I did.
Right, and the Haitian Revolution was a beacon, in fact, for the slave rebellions here in America.
I do know about some of that stuff, and I don't want you to branch out into other things. Like some people will say that the Second Amendment was about putting down slave rebellions, which sounds like which is crap to me. I don't think that was a big thing. But the thing is, I don't think that slavery was actually detrimental. It doesn't really create wealth like some people think, because the Confederacy was kind of an economic basket case, and even someone like Sherman, General Sherman, who was not a big name yet in 61, wrote to one of his southern friends saying, hey, don't break away because you guys are an economic basket case. You don't have anything.
Right, but to the slave-owning, plantation-owning class, it created a certain amount of wealth. And they had a lot of money. Right, and they wanted
they
to hold on to
money,
it.
But
anyway,
what did it do for the structure of the country?
Right. What's your bottom line point in bringing all this up?
The bottom line point is just that I just don't like to hear this history described as if it's in a vacuum, you know, that the Europeans were just kidnapping people from Africa and bringing them here, when it was just a world, it was a global thing that was going on and just tapped into it. It was a blot on humankind, and it's not, the U.S. shouldn't be singled out. Because after all, you said you were in Italy. I mean, well, name a place in the world that you'd, we'd hate every place. You could say, oh, Italy, oh, I don't like Italy. They were founded on a big slave empire. Or India was founded on, you know, they had loads of slaves. That's where all their wealth and history came from.
Well, how about
any place.
Well, how about the colonization itself, then? Do you think that was justified?
What colonization? Of America?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
You
know, the thing is that there. Someone once mentioned, wrote that there were like five huge mass migrations of humans in world history, and that this was one of them.
Well, calling it just migration does it kind of depoliticizes it, doesn't it? I mean,
that's right. But you can, yeah, and people will go where to places. I know it wasn't.
We got it. We're already at 9 o'clock. Yeah. Hey, we're already at 9 o'clock. I didn't realize that. We got to go.
See you later.
Okay, I didn't realize we're that far gone. This is Paul Rowan, Wednesday Talk Radio. Bye bye.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on Oregon Community Media radio stations from Ashland and Astoria to Warm Springs. Again, that's the 31st annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th, noon to 10 p.m. or so, every night at Waterfront Park in Portland and on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.